afternoon, the Southern Nevada panel has an oral argument, and hopefully I've pronounced these folks' names correctly. Fortunate, a Nevada corporation versus Playbook Publishing LLC, Playbook Management, Jack Cornell, Julie Roston, and then there are some other folks here, including Himmelfarb and Associates, case number 72930. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I had asked the clerk to visit with you folks about how you intended to divide up your time, and I'd like you to put that on the record if you could, because there's a lot of competing claims and cross appeals and the like. So first, Ms. Hartwell, do you wish to reserve any time of your 15 minutes?
Yes, I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, fine. All right, and then could you indicate the time that's going to be divided between the folks who are respondents or cross appellants or respondents?
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Dan Carabino for the respondent slash cross appellant. I will have 8.5 minutes, two of which I will reserve for the rebuttal.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Justice. My name is Matthew Dushoff. I represent Himmelfarb parties. I will just have 6.5 minutes.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you.
All right. And because the Wooten parties are unrepresented, they won't be able to argue. Oh, and you won't be able to argue for them either. Okay. All right. Ms. Hartwell, are you ready to proceed?
Yes. Doreen Spears Hartwell, bar number 7525. Good afternoon. My name is Doreen Spears Hartwell, and I was counsel for Fortunate Inc. in the district court for the second trial of the two-part trial. That started in June of 2013. Fortunate is filed an initial lawsuit against two of its former employees, Jack Cornell, its chief compliance officer, and also director of business development, as well as Dwayne Wooten, who was the head of technology for Fortunet for approximately 12 years prior to his termination from Fortunet. The basis of this lawsuit is basically, the main point of the lawsuit was misappropriation of trade secrets and basically a civil conspiracy between the main defendants and the Himmelfarb parties. Based on fraudulent inducement, undisclosed information pertaining to a distributorship agreement, which is the main issue between Fortunet and the Himmelfarb party, and Fortunet. Fortunet's appealing multiple orders and judgments based on errors in law, the jury's manifest disregard of the jury instructions relating to Fortunet's aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty claim, and its civil conspiracy to convert Fortunet's assets, and this is with regards to the first trial. I'm going to try to,
With your indulgence, Chief, can we maybe jump to the witness exclusion issue?
Yes.
And the testimony, striking of the testimony?
Yes.
Perhaps, Justice Stiglitz, if you don't mind, I did have one clarifying point that I'd ask. In this case, personally, is a trust, his trust in this case, personally or not? There was some indication in the brief that he was a party. He's not on the caption. I don't see him anywhere.
They were
in the pleadings on appeal.
They were dismissed as parties prior to trial. Prior to the first trial, correct.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. And so why don't you proceed with Justice Stiglitz's question?
Yes.
Well, obviously, the court found a violation. You agree it was a violation?
No, we don't agree that it was a violation. Mr. Itkis was the designated corporate representative for the first trial, and he sat through the entire trial. He was also the main witness on behalf of Fortunate during the first trial. And, of course, it was pretty much the second trial was sort of a repeat of the first trial with some additional claims solely for the parties that had filed bankruptcy. And so, therefore, Fortunate could not bring its claims against Jack Cornell personally or Julie Weston personally. The witness exclusion rule was to exclude witnesses basically from hearing the testimony at the time of trial, witnesses who were going to be testifying. We did not believe that that rule applied to Mr. Itkis. One, as we said, he was the main witness from the first trial. He was already designated as the corporate representative at the first trial, and he could have been as at the second trial also, but for his schedule. And so...
So was somebody else designated?
We had general counsel was present during the second trial, throughout the trial. Mr. Itkis was also as the... like I said, the person literally with the most knowledge with regards to the claims.
Was the general counsel a designee for the second trial or just present?
He was designated. Okay. He actually was present at counsel's table throughout the first trial.
And the second trial?
Oh, sorry. The second trial. Sorry. The general counsel actually was not with the company until 2015.
Okay.
And so he was not a fact. He wasn't a witness in any capacity. As a party, Mr. Itkis, as like I said, as the main witness, he was literally at the first trial. He was on the stand for a total of 6 days. The direct examination was just but one day. The cross examination was over 5 days by the defendants and counterclaimants. He was the person who had all of the conversations with the main defendant, Jack Cornell, with regards to the formation of the contract, the execution of the employment contract that was at issue during the first trial. He was, under the exclusionary rule, it doesn't allow for in this particular case, literally, there wasn't an order stating to the extent that the exclusionary rule was in place that officers of the corporation or other individuals who are necessary with regards to the prosecution of the case aren't allowed to participate in helping literally put on the case. So in preparation for trial and just in general, Mr. Itkis, we asked for daily transcripts. It was clear that Mr. Itkis was going to be reviewing those transcripts, that the transcripts were not just for counsel, but for in terms of preparing for trial as we went on with the various witnesses, but also that Mr. Itkis was going to be involved in that process. I think it was the exclusion of Mr. Itkis as a witness was, I think, unduly harsh. I think it was an improper application of the exclusionary rule. And there's absolutely no prejudice to the defendants with regards to Mr. Itkis reading the transcript and actually in terms of his preparing for his testimony. But also, literally, he sat through the entire trial. We're talking about testimony that and things that happened from the late 90s to, you know, through the mid-2000s. And I think that the exclusion of Mr. Ickes' testimony goes more towards what I believe was a demonstrated antagonism on the part of Judge Gonzalez against Fortunate that basically permeated the proceedings from the initial trial all the way through the second trial.
Reading the excerpts of when he was on the stand in the second trial, he started, and I don't have the transcript with me, but I read, he started talking about somebody else's testimony, and that's when everybody jumped up and objected. And I can't offhand remember who that was. Was that somebody that he sat through that first?
Yeah, that's the main defendant, okay. Jack Cornell. And it was all with right. regards to conversations that the parties had, literally, prior to, obviously, the initiation of the lawsuit and the fact that Mr. Cornell's testimony was different from the first trial. And so Mr. Itkis was addressing that issue. And it wasn't his comments were, like I said, basically addressing something that the main defendant said with regards to conversations and interactions between Mr. Itkis and Mr. Cornell prior to the initiation of the lawsuit. And I said, in testimony that was contrary to what Mr. Cornell testified to during the first trial when he was on the stand. And I think a major, and I know the other side is going to say that basically it's not sufficient to, with regards to the court's argument that the court was biased, and I think he said antagonistic towards Fortunate throughout both proceedings. And there are, and I cite to the record of just numerous, literally starting from opening statement all the way through closing arguments, just numerous times of Judge Gonzalez literally cutting off, I wasn't counsel during the first trial, but cutting counsel off and starting just from the beginning of opening statements. And these were interruptions and admonishments in front of the jury, and without an objection from the other side. It was literally the judge acting more as an advocate for the defendants, the pro se, and your represented defendants versus being an impartial judge on the bench. And that was, and I say in the brief, to clearly just disparate treatment during this process when literally during opening statement, the other side's appealing to the sympathy of the jury with regards to arguing that this lawsuit's causing them to file bankruptcy and the comments of that nature. And despite that, there's no admonishment of the other side at all when these improper comments are made. And many of the objections to those comments and requests to have such actions stricken are overruled. This happened in the second trial also. Literally, I was just amazed throughout the trial. The court would make sua sponte, would call us up to the bench, and there's no objection coming from the other side. And when we get to the bench, literally, she was arguing with me with regards to what's the relevance of that. You can't go there and so forth. And literally, there wasn't an objection from the other side, and they're not even necessarily don't have to argue because the court is basically making the arguments for them. To the point at one time when I go back to sit down, when I go to sit down, she says, on the record, objection sustained. And I said, Your Honor, there wasn't an objection. You know, you called us up. And as a result of that, she actually sanctioned me. She held me in contempt of court for actually clarifying the record. And I made it clear even at that point. And she dismissed the jury to basically hold me in contempt of court with regards to that. And I said, Your Honor, I was just clarifying the record. You sustained an objection when there wasn't one made. And it wasn't said rudely or in a snarky tone or anything. It truly was just a clarification of the record. And at that point, I also pointed out to her that throughout these proceedings that she had been glowering, literally glowering at me from the bench as I'm doing my direct examinations. And when she calls us up and she makes her argument as to why she's calling us up and then shushing me away from the bench in front of the jury. And I said, Your Honor, I think that's impacting and influencing the jury when you're doing this like in front of them. And her response to this was, Ms. Hartwell, I have nothing but the utmost respect for you and all that you do in the community. But your client, however, I have developed feelings towards your client during these proceedings. And that is an express statement of bias. It's not that she's developed opinions with regards to the case based on the motions and hearings. No, she has developed feelings of antagonism towards my client, which have been demonstrated throughout the proceedings, leading up to the striking of Mr. Ickes' testimony, completely striking his testimony in this case, based on the alleged violation of the exclusionary rule. And again, I said there was absolutely no prejudice to the other side. I don't spend too much time on this issue here.
I'd like to ask you a question about not just the rule, but the use of transcripts in preparing a witness who has been properly excluded. I understand you argue that the witness should still be permitted to be present or to review those transcripts. And I'm troubled by that. It seems like that process supersedes or gets around the purpose behind the exclusionary rule. Would you comment about that?
Sure. And the purpose of the exclusionary rule is to prevent witnesses from fabricating or making up testimony in response to things that have been said during the trial. That's not this case. that couldn't be this case. Like I said, Mr. Itkis was the main witness in the case, the main witness in the trial, especially the first trial that he sat through. He was the only witness that had pretty much knowledge with regards to a number of the issues that resulted from Defendant Cornell's use of Fortinet resources, modification of Fortinet software, the implications with regards to the Nevada Gaming Control Board.
Let's just say, for purposes of argument for a moment, mm-hmm. he was properly excluded. Is it your position that a properly excluded and excluded witness subject to the rule of exclusion can review daily transcripts of the trial and not run afoul of the rule?
Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not.
So, if the court, and I'm not saying the court has resolved that issue, that's why we're here, but if the court were to conclude that Itkis was properly excluded, then his review of the transcript would be a violation of the exclusionary rule and potentially sanctionable.
Yes.
Okay. So let's turn to the sanctions. I'd like you to comment on that. It strikes me as striking the witness who's already sat in the first trial throughout all of the first trials a bit over the top. And I'll let your position. But I want to hear from the other side about this. I'm trying to understand, it's a complicated case, a lot of facts, but I'm trying to understand how anybody's prejudiced by striking the testimony of some guy who's already been sitting in a trial for 11 days.
The only party that was prejudiced was Fortinet. Literally, all of the testimony that Mr. Itkis would have testified, what he had already testified to with regards to the misappropriation of trade secrets claim, and also with regards to damages relating to the deceptive trade practice claim, was stricken from the record. Meanwhile, there was absolutely no prejudice to the other side with regards to Mr. Itkis reading the testimony. It was literally a huge windfall for them that the judge struck his testimony. He was only on the stand for, I think, 3 hours at the time that his testimony was stricken, and he had...
In the context of this somewhat complicated case, what was the significance of the date of 9-9 or 9, whatever it was, and 9-11 to the facts of the case? The difference in the testimony...
The initial trial was from June of 2013 through mid-July. And Mr. Itkis's comment?
Itkis's comment about Cornell's testimony.
It was with regards to Cornell's employment agreement, which was signed, I think, in 2000. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Cornell had testified previously about an amendment to the employment agreement that Mr. Cornell said happened immediately at the time that the initial agreement was entered into. And Mr. Itkis is like, no, that happened days later. That wasn't the same date. And literally, that was the comment or relating to that issue.
Okay, thank you. Your time has expired. And I know you wanted to reserve 3 minutes, but I wanted these arguments to be maintained on time. So I think we understand your position, Ms. Hartwell.
Okay. Oops,
good afternoon, Your Honors. Dan Cherugino. I represent the Respondent Playbook entities. And just to be clear, so is my time starting now?
Yes.
Okay. This entire case can be resolved in two words, preempted and permitted. Now, Fortinet elected to give the widest possible sweep to NRS 600A in this case by relating everything and everybody to that claim. We see that at Second Amendment Complaint, JA173, paragraphs 19 through 60, among others. Now, the practical and legal impact of that choice was to preempt all other tort claims. France is the seminal case on that point and plainly states as much. Plus, we had factual preemption. The district court made a factual finding after 10 days of trial at Trial 1 that Mr. Itkis, quote-unquote, undoubtedly and clearly knew of everything Jack and the entities were doing, And we see that at JA 3306, page 5, paragraph 5. So the single tort issue on appeal is whether the district court properly granted 50A relief on the 600A claim itself. And the answer to that is yes. And we know that based on Fortunet's own cited case, the IMAX case. In the IMAX case, the trial court granted pretrial summary judgment based on an insufficient description of the trade secret at issue. In our case, after 10 days of trial, the district court granted 50A relief based on an insufficient description of the trade secrets at issue, which is found in Court's Exhibit 2, this is it, JA 1634.
I don't mean to take you off what your issue you're talking about right now, but going back to the issue of striking the testimony of Mr. Ickes, what was the prejudice to you, your clients, based on his reviewing the daily transcript since he sat through the whole first trial? What sure. prejudice was it to your party?
Sure. The issue on that, Your Honor, is Mr. Ickes was not simply reviewing for refreshing and then bringing the same testimony he brought at trial one. He brought new information to the table. And that's the problem.
In the 3 hours that he testified?
Yes. Yes. That was the problem. And so when he did acknowledge, yes, I reviewed these transcripts, and then he was tailoring the testimony to meet the new circumstances at trial two, that became the problem. And Your Honors will note, we moved for mistrial. Judge Gonzalez denied that. She did not give the harshest sanction available. She merely went with striking Mr. Ickes. And there's no, the real issue is there's no prejudice to Fortunet. He testified on day 10 of the second trial. There were numerous other witnesses, numerous other documents on exactly what Mr. Ickes was going to testify to, including Fortunet's CFO, among other people, and other Fortunet employees. So that's the issue with respect to Ickes. Striking him was more than proper and more than fair.
Well, how do you tailor your testimony when you're on record for 10 years talking about this? You have depositions, you have a whole first trial. I mean, why isn't cross-examination and an admonishment for the jury sufficient to ameliorate any problem, to point out to the jury and give a curative instruction?
So I think the issue comes down to when Mr. Ickes started talking about were, again, very new facts never disclosed, including using words like, we retained an expert to go look at certain issues that, or certain behavior by Mr. Cornell, none that were disclosed on those points. Those topics never came up anywhere prior to Mr. Ickes on that day raising it. And so that's where it becomes prejudicial on day 10 of a trial when it's first presented in front of a jury. That's the problem. Now, the substantive matters as to possibly what Jack did or did not do, they had other witnesses to testify to that. They had documents to address that. The point is that Mr. Ickes coming in and realizing 10 days in, this is not going well, so I'm going to add some fireworks to the equation, that's not proper, and that defeats the purpose of the exclusionary rule.
So you disagree that Mr. Ickes was essential to the presentation of Fortunet's case?
He was absolutely not essential for a number of reasons. Like you said, Fortunet's CFO had already testified. Other Fortunet witnesses had testified. It was day 10. If he was essential, one would think he would be called earlier in the matter. Plus, there was plenty of other documentary evidence. Fortunet was never handcuffed in terms of the scope and scale of what they could talk about.
But then why would you ask for a mistrial? Why would you ask for the testimony to be stricken if he's just of no real value?
It was the nature of the comments raised in front of the jury for the first time were salacious, to put it mildly. And when you add to that the notion of, we retained an expert who we never disclosed to, and he told me and opined X, Y, and Z. Those are real problems to occur in front of a jury. And notwithstanding that,
but you can make objections to that. You had his whole testimony, which before was 6 days of testimony, stricken.
Fair, yes, right. But the only part that was stricken was Mr. Ickes. And again, there were numerous witnesses, numerous documents, all going to topics that Mr. Akis was supposedly going to testify to. Fortunet has not identified anywhere in his briefing, this is the topic that we were never able to address. They were able to address it otherwise. So striking him surgically, more than proper.
Do you dispute that Mr. Akis was a designated corporate representative for the first part, the first trial, the first portion of the trial?
We do not dispute at the first trial. Okay. But again, that was 3 years earlier. There was a designee at the second trial, Mr. Jared Gage, who sat through every day. And again, as Justice Hardesty pointed out, Mr. Akis was not a party to the case. He was not a designee. He was not essential.
Is there any authority that you can only have one designated corporate representative?
Well, I would say the plain language of the statute only talks about one. It doesn't say, it doesn't have a parenthetical S, so like multiple designees.
The plain language of the statute also says, hear the other witnesses, not read.
Sure. Well, I can also, you know, attempt to supplement the record with the case, whether or not you can have more than one designee. Having said that, again, plenty of evidence that Fortunet had. And remember, this is the second trial, and that never should have happened based on the statutory preemption of 600A.
Okay, Mr. Dishoff, do you want to reserve time for your rebuttal?
Well, yes, 2 minutes for the cross appeal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Matthew Dishoff. I represent Bruce Himmelfarb of Himmelfarb & Associates. Bruce is sitting in the audience right now. I'm here just for the first trial, because that's all that we were at. Fortunet proposed six legal arguments. As I have limited time before you, I want to make your job a little easier by addressing several of Fortunet's legal arguments that can be summarily disposed of. The verdict form, the J&OV, and the acknowledgement of ethics form. The verdict form was not objected to, therefore it's waived. The J&OV against Bruce Himmelfarb was never made in the district court, first time brought up on appeal, so that's also waived. The acknowledgement of ethics form that they claim was not properly admitted, well, they didn't include that in their pretrial disclosures, so therefore the judge did not abuse her discretion in not admitting that. So those are three arguments. The fourth argument is the burden of proof in a civil conspiracy. And frankly, this is a novel argument because the Supreme Court in the state has never discussed what the burden of proof is for civil conspiracy. Now, but the court doesn't have to reach that in this case. Why? Because we know that to succeed on a civil conspiracy, you must prove the underlying element of the predicate. And in this case, that was fraud. And we know that because they admitted as such at 12JA2633, 12JA2616. And fraud, the burden of proof, is clear and convincing. Now, even if Judge Gonzalez had this as a jury instruction and that was an error, it would be harmless error. Matter of fact, the court, as you can see, the jury ruled heavily in favor of Bruce Himmelfarb in this action, and they failed to show how a different result would have occurred if it wasn't a clear and convincing standard. This brings up to the fifth argument, which you brought up in the other case, which is bias. They failed to show that there was an extrajudicial source, and that's under, that is, in re petition, we call Dunleavy, 104 Nevada 784. They have to show that there's an extrajudicial source outside the courtroom in order to show bias. They have failed to do so. Anything that they've shown was everything that happened in the course of the trial. Therefore, that argument also fails.
But even if it's not an extrajudicial source, can the judge display open hostility toward a party in front of a jury? I mean, wouldn't that create a problem no matter what the source of it is? Wouldn't that be a problem?
If it got to a certain point, I don't know the case law on that, but I can tell you in the first jury trial, that never happened. I apologize. I can't talk about the second jury trial. I was there for the first jury. That never happened. And frankly, if there was a disdain towards Mr. Akis, it wasn't because there were abject lies throughout, but she never showed that through the first trial. So I'm going to spend the balance of my time talking about the attorney's fees issue in this case. And you know, it is within the sound discretion of the court to grant attorney's fees. And any review of the granting of attorney's fees would be under an abuse of discretion standard. Under 18.010 sub 2b, if the opposing party brings a claim without reasonable grounds, the court can grant attorney's fees. And the legislature has deemed for the courts to liberally construe 18.010. And the intent behind that is to stop the frivolous and vexatious litigation that Fortunate brought today against Bruce Himmelfarb. The judge found that Fortunate, quote, Fortunate brought and maintained its claims against the Himmelfarb parties and defenses to Himmelfarb and Associates counterclaims without reasonable grounds and to harass the Himmelfarb parties as contemplated by NRS 18.010 sub 2b. We can talk about the reasonableness of our fees under Brunzell. That's not even an issue. Because Mr. Rounds specifically stated that I don't think the amount of the attorney's fees that they requested regarding us are unreasonable. That's at 14 JA 3135 through 36. But however, Fortunate comes up with this novel argument. Go, hey, wait a minute. Well, at least five of our 25 arguments made it to the jury. Therefore, you can't get attorney's fees. However, this argument is not the law. And frankly, limping past summary judgment doesn't mean your claim has merits. This court has found in Bergman v. Boyce, 109 Nevada 670, that a party can get attorney's fees under 18.010, even if some of the causes of action go to the jury. And I think it's telling that Fortunate never cited to Bergman in their reply, because they know we're right. The basis of this case was whether Mr. Himmelfarb procured Colusa, Fantasy Springs, and Virgin River as clients for Fortunate. The jury found overwhelming evidence that Bruce did procure these casinos for Fortunate. And I think it's also telling that Mr. Goodkiss at JA1316 admitted that if Bruce was out, he was gone, that he wouldn't have to pay anyone these commissions, and Fortunate would be able to keep all the money. Fortunate initiated this case, the second amended complaint, on a false premise. Fortunate knew exactly at the time that the second amended complaint was filed against Bruce on September 7, 2012, that the factual predicates were untrue. How do we know that? One, they knew they never lost their client Palace at Lemoore. They claimed that actions by Bruce and by Jack caused them to lose their largest client. But they never lost it. They were continuing making revenue all the way up through trial from that client. We're talking over $3 million of damages, they claimed. And we didn't find out till trial that that was not true. Mr. Itkus lied on two bankruptcy filings to the court months, just months before this jury trial, claiming that they still lost Palace at Lemoore when they never did. They lied when they said Winteroth was the one who procured Fantasy Springs. That's at JA 1290, 1293, 1296, and 1298. That Mr. Espinoza didn't procure Colusa. That's at 1283. They never paid him a commission because he never got Colusa. That was Bruce. They lied about not knowing who procured Virgin River. That was at JA 1300 and 1301. And this trade secret, which he said was the main issue. Main issue. Just came up and said that. On day five, when Judge Gonzalez said, okay, I've got to know, where is this trade secret? They merely produced a response to an interrogatory. That was at JA 2414 to 22 and JA 2546. They had no case against Bruce Himmelfarb. All the causes of action against him in his individual capacity were dismissed, or they voluntarily dismissed it before it reached the jury. Bruce had to defend himself from the very beginning.
Okay, counsel, I think we understand your position. Oh. Your time's expired.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Ms. Hartwell, I'll give you 3 minutes to, in addition to whatever remaining time you have. And Mr. Sirachino will have 2.5 minutes when we're complete.
Okay.
Yes. In addition to whatever other time she had remaining, I don't think it was much.
So with regards to, I guess I'll start with FEMA FARP first. Clearly, Fortunet did not bring a frivolous claim. And as cited in our brief, the impetus for Fortunet's claim against FEMA FARP was the whole kickback scheme. Fortunet's contract with FEMA FARP was very specific. FEMA FARP was to use its best efforts to procure placement of Fortunet's leasing system and maintain those relationships. The testimony at trial was really clear, and it's set forth in our brief. Specifically, FEMA FARP admits that the only thing that he did was provide two names to Jack Cornell with regards to procuring anything, and he did not maintain any relationships. Fortunet found out at trial that, during trial, or I should say prior to the trial, that FEMA FARP was paying 80% of the monies that it was receiving from Fortunet back to Jack Cornell, the compliance officer for Fortunet. That was a violation of Cornell's fiduciary duty, and it was also a violation, an express violation of the distributorship agreement, which prohibited FEMA FARP from assigning any duties or subcontracting any of its obligations under that agreement to any parties, period. The record's really clear that Cornell never informed Fortunet that he was actually receiving money from FEMA FARP. And I did it clear in order from his trial testimony to make it clear. Cornell gave lots of half-truths and then mixed things up and some clear untruths too to give the impression that he made a disclosure. He had one conversation with Yuri Ickes stating, FEMA FARP wants to know if I can assist when he's out of the country, and that's it. And after he had that conversation with Ickes, he then went to FEMA FARP and said, you need to give me 80% of the commissions that you get for the placement of this. He never informed Fortunet of that. It was a violation of the code of ethics, and it was also a violation of FEMA FARP's agreement. With regards to, it was clear, and they hid this. They concealed this from Fortunet by taking the 80% of the payments that were being made to FEMA FARP. FEMA FARP then made those payments to the wives.
To see what your response was as far as Mr. Ickes wouldn't have added anything else as far as testimony had it not been stricken.
Absolutely not accurate. And I listed a number of the things that Mr. Ickes did not get to talk about. With regards to the testimony and the misappropriation of trade secrets, Mr. Ickes was the one that he actually drafted the provisional application, which is a patent, or provisional patent application is a trade secret in and of itself, which came to the record. The testimony in the record stated that was a trade secret, and there were other, with regards to damages, beyond deceptive trade practice, with regards to the actions that the misappropriation of trade secrets claim and the history of how those patent applications and things came along.
I do have one more question. May I ask?
Go ahead, Ms.
So what about his claim that a CFO had already testified?
Absolutely.
And other people had testified?
No one else testified to that. The CFO solely testified to the cost, the overhead costs and operational costs that were the resources that Cornell used in breach of his fiduciary duty and in breach of the employment contract and so forth. Absolutely no one else had knowledge with regards to the testimony that Mr. Ickes would have provided, and no one else testified to those issues either. There's nothing else in the record with regards to that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Hartwell.
So on the cross appeal, as I was mentioning, the legal preemptive effect of 600A means there should have been no other common law tort claims in this case. In addition, the factual preemption of Mr. Akis's knowledge, as found by Judge Gonzalez after 10 days of trial, means there shouldn't have been any other all tort claims in this case were negated, and we cite that in response at paragraph 38 to page 38 to 40. But in addition, the contract itself, the plain language, permitted Jack to do everything that he did in this case. He was only not allowed to be in competition. He wasn't. Now, with respect to the entitlement of fees, what happens is, once we preempt and apply that permission that negates the claims, there is no N1 at trial one, which means my clients prevail 100% and recover less than $20,000. It's just an application of 18.0102A. Secondly, the employment agreement itself, again, specifically provides an entitlement to fees. There's only two conditions in that contract. One, that Fortunet sues somebody, anybody, about an ownership stake in work product. That's what they did. And two, that it involved Jack. You can't be more involved than a defendant. Two conditions are met. The result is Jack's entitled to all of his fees under the contract. It's that simple. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments and especially your briefs on a very complicated case. We appreciate your arguments here today, and the case will stand submitted. Thank you.